Welcome to Next Round with Dale McDermott and David W. Higgins, your go-to podcast for a fresh take on the economy, politics, and society. I'm Dale McDermott.
And I'm David W. Higgins. Join us as we explore the issues shaping Ireland, the UK, Europe, and beyond.
For the thinkers, the dreamers, and the doers, this is Next Round. Well, hello, and welcome to the next round, the latest episode of our podcast. And it has been a busy week since we last met, David. I hope you're well. And I know, you know, over the last couple of days, there's been big changes. We've had, you know, just come out of the Fine Gael Ard Eisteacht at the weekend, where new Fine Gael leader Simon Harris gave his first speech to the Ard Eisteacht and the party faithful, as they say, and the reactions from that. And then straight into his election as Taoiseach today in the Dáil, where he became Taoiseach and he announced his new cabinet. And you know, I think, you know, the inflection point, I think, really came to life today. And we also, at the same time, saw Leo Varadkar finish his term as Taoiseach. And he gave his final speech in the Dáil as Taoiseach, where he reflected on his period of time there. And also, I think, you know, gave some quite interesting pieces around some of the challenges that were facing the government over the last number of years. He started with housing, and he referenced that how much of an international challenge it was. And despite the fact that Ireland is very much an island, it's not a separate planet. And how Ireland, as with much of the crises over the last number of years, from the great financial crisis to COVID, it is a player in a global world. And the way to engage outwardly is the way to bring the country forward. And also some of the other elements around, you know, he felt that, actually, I thought this piece was actually quite interesting about, he wished he didn't play it as safe.
Around COVID,
for example.
And just to say housing as well. So he reflected, I think, on 6-1 yesterday on the advice that the government were given coming out of the financial crisis and coming out of the IMF bailouts and all that, and he would have been a minister at that time. And it's a reflection, if you go back to that time, a lot of the forecasts did have Ireland growing again, but didn't have us launching higher in GDP numbers, launching higher in population numbers in the way that we did. And I think the caution he was reflecting on there was that getting house building going again just wasn't on their radar. Now, I'm reading a bit into that, but I think that that's what he was trying to make a point on, but also COVID too.
Yeah, and I think also the piece around, he said that, you know, as a government and as a leader, you'll take lots of advice, and the advice lots of times gives is advice of caution. Take it slow. Don't overreact. Almost don't be as bold as one possibly can be. And his reflection, I thought was quite interesting. As a leader leaving the hot seat, he wishes that he had have done some things sooner, which I thought was an interesting observation. And also made references to other things, such as health, the improvements that have been made in health. Sinn Féin, of course, later on said that there haven't been as much of an improvement. But I think also interestingly was around, you know, kind of the really big challenges facing Europe as a whole now around security. How, you know, Sweden has abandoned 200 years of neutrality. You know, there's a full-scale war in Europe. Other countries around Europe talking about, do they bring back national services? And how those challenges really put some things into context. Now, of course, then, Mary Lou MacDonald, the other possible Taoiseach, pending an election, gave a different view and gave a different perspective.
Yes, yeah. On the caution point, you know, sometimes the caution is warranted. Though I'm thinking of during the COVID era, where there was a lot of enthusiasm about how much money was getting spent, and there was this view that because interest rates had gone so low at the time, that the Irish government could just keep spending a fair bit. But, you know, there were a lot of voices in the Department of Finance, and there was I believe a leaked memo on this. I think this was about housing. So the topic was, okay, we've spent a lot, interest rates are low, let's throw a ton of money at housing. And the Department of Finance came along and said, look, we can't guarantee that the era of low interest rates will actually exist forever. Interest rates tend to actually go up, especially if you begin to run higher levels of debt. Now, that was actually a caution that the Department of Finance put out that was then proven to be correct. Because about 2 years later, interest rates had gone higher, and they are structurally higher. And that's not to say that you shouldn't invest anything in housing. Far from it, you do need to step up the level of investment in housing. But that is an example of actually caution as an advice, which then being followed would have been the right thing, or at least what the department were revising the Taoiseach at the time was pretty sound on that one.
Well, I think now, like speaking on the point of caution, the new Taoiseach made the announcement at the Fine Gael Ard Eisteacht at the weekend, the ambition to end the housing crisis crisis once and for all. This policy statement of the aim to build 200 homes over the next 5 years. Now, the question comes to mind, which is this believable and is this credible? Because we've had this statement made before. I believe Simon Coveney, when he was Minister for Housing, that was his ambition to end homelessness and to end the housing crisis. And you know, I think that was not fully realized. So, David, what do you think? Is it believable? Is there the credibility there? Can it be done?
The biggest thing that all parties like to do is tell you the number of homes that are being built. The harder thing to do is to say, will they be affordable or not? And what effect that extra supply will have on house prices. Sinn Féin have shot themselves in the foot by actually putting a number on it, which is, you know, X number of 100,000 that a person can expect to pay in Dublin. Nobody knows by the end of this decade where wages will be, where inflation will have gone in the couple of years. To say you can get a particular number on the house price on average is just impossible. But what we should be looking to try and do is lower the cost of housing relative to incomes. Now, I'm not saying for certain that Simon Harris should have come out with a target on that. It's also very hard to target that. But you could, if you build 250,000 homes, there is just no guarantee that it alone will materially make housing more affordable. Why do I say that? In the past census period, so if I look at 2016, going from 2020, that when you look between the two censuses, we've added a lot to the housing stock, but we've also seen significant additions to our population, a mix of natural increase that tends to come census on census anyway, but also significant volumes of inward migration into Ireland. And that census was done before you add on the additional people who've come from Ukraine and you add on asylum seekers. So the challenge for the government, so you asked me if this is credible. It is quite credible because housing supply, which was in the single thousand digits, has now risen to over 30,000. And there is confidence amongst the government that they can at least meet or exceed some of those targets. If you get a run rate that goes to 40,000 to 50,000, and it would then have to go around to 60 or 70,000 some at some point later, kind of like 6 years from now, you would be able to get another 250,000 homes built. That I don't doubt, because the construction industry is now humming in a way that it wasn't in the past couple of years, because so many builders were literally bust. So many of them went under. So many people were scared to actually work in the construction sector that it wasn't a viable place to work. You now have some of the construction related sectors have been going up higher in things like the CAO points or for Leaving Cert students in recent years.
So demand for it is increasing. People want to get into this industry.
And there's a sense that there's stability there now. And the government's whole project over the past couple of years has not just been to revive the construction industry, but to do it sustainably in a way that isn't. So one thing that isn't being done now is the construction industry, and in many ways isn't reliant on the Irish banks to fund it. What's happened? You've had players like some of these are listed on the stock exchanges, not just in Ireland, but abroad. That means they can raise capital externally. Now, why is that a good thing? If there's another bust and one of those companies goes under and the bill doesn't fall to the Irish taxpayer, potentially through another bank bailout, it would fall to international investors. But the bigger thing about this, the whole point about here is that these companies aren't taking on significant debt volumes. They're not speculating in the way that some of the players did before. So the risk of a major crash in the construction and housing sector just doesn't present itself in the way that the last boom gave us. We haven't seen just a rocketing up of houses in very rural areas like Roscommon or counties where there wasn't significant housing demand. What you're seeing is a more gentle, more kind of development, which is definitely meeting an undermet demand at the moment.
Yeah, and I saw as well today the SRI released a report. So the Economic and Social Research Institute released a report on the back of Mr. Harris's aim for 200 homes in the next 5 years. This would actually require additional services that needed to be required by the government, which turns out that around 375 extra GPs, 1,250 extra hospital beds. So in addition to building more homes and having more people live in those homes, with that means that you have to have more services, more planning, and of course more funding and expenditure by government in order to do so.
And there's a problem with that, right? Implicit in that forecast is the idea that you actually have extra people. So as much as Harris has talked about extra supply leading to young people of our generation, Dale, get out of the pox room and into homes of their own. Well, sorry, if we're talking about people who are already in the country obtaining homes, then you don't need extra GPs, but don't need extra hospital beds. Because what you're saying there is that the average household size would fall. That by providing extra homes, that you're simply just moving people around within the country, people who are kind of stuck in their box room, right? But actually housing overcrowding When you look at the metrics for that in Ireland, we tend to come out on the way lower end in Europe for a metric like that. What you really are saying is that the 250,000 extra homes are going to spur maybe a higher birth rate. Who knows? You might spur some emigrants who have left Ireland in recent years to come home. Maybe that's the case. But more likely, what you're going to spur is our very successful multinational sector to continue hiring. But some of that hiring also takes place from abroad. I mean, we have a system of work permits in Ireland, and the tech sector is a big availer of this, where you can bring people from far corners of the earth, very specialized people, to work in some of these European hubs and centers in Ireland and to really make a contribution to these big global firms. I don't want to speak as if I'm harshly skeptical of that, because that has been a major, major success for Ireland. But if just reading into those ESRI numbers, that is effectively what they're saying, is that you're going to have another leap higher in inward migration alongside the 250,000 homes. It's not reason not to build them. But the bigger focus actually should be on the type of homes. You do need more affordable and social homes. And I don't think you're going to have a meaningful turnaround in the affordability of housing unless some wider metrics change. Interest rates, when they're higher, tend to be associated with more affordable housing. That's what the decades of the 1960s, 70s, 80s, and early 90s, our parents' generation, when housing was more affordable, that's the era when housing was more affordable. I could go on about this, but I do think that supply
And
alone.
I'd never paint you as a skeptic, David, either.
Oh no. Anyone who knows me and has seen some of the commentary I've put out in recent years is I'm very pro-supply. I very much favor getting as many homes as built. And I really get riled up when I see, particularly in suburban areas of Dublin, which you and I, Dale, know well, that there is objections that just come up and get spread all around the place whenever there are new supply looking to be built, particularly when things like apartments ever go up. You get arguments getting made that, oh, the people in these are going to be transitory, this sort of thing. They're not going to integrate into the community, this sort of thing. And look, some of that is true, but other times it's just an argument to try and stop needed supply coming in.
Well, and of course, that's an interesting point around, the people and families from South Dublin arguing about how transient these people are going to be. Well, I guarantee you, a lot of these people have transient kids living in the likes of London, where I am now, or New York, or and they're transient, you could argue, but I don't see them complaining about that.
And look, if there weren't enough apartments and other places for the likes of you and others to live, you might have not gone abroad. You might have been stuck in the box room still as well. We'd have more kids in the box
Exactly.
room potentially. But just on that, you raise an interesting point about just how welcoming people are in cities around the world. It was remarkable to see. I mentioned about visas and that being very much a lever that countries push or pull when it comes to inward migration. New Zealand have a new government. They've tilted to the right, although it'd be wrong to say that their prior government was fully left wing on this issue.
The New Zealand right.
So everything about left right changes slightly when you get down to Australia and New Zealand, at least when it comes
Yes.
to migration. These are countries that are so far away from the rest of the world that they've always had limits on migration. They always have to be very tight on their borders. You can't bring in nuts, fruit, meat, like livestock, any sort of. These guys are so strict at their borders. But the point about New Zealand is that they are now looking to restrict the number of visas that are granted to immigrants coming into the country. And this is the sort of method that Irish people tend to use to get into either Australia or New Zealand. I mean, Australia is the bigger one that Irish people were concerned about. That the number of visas granted was about 10,000 in the year to mid-22. And it's over 21,000 now in the year to mid 23. So you're talking about a doubling in those numbers. But when you look at the list of countries, many other countries have doubled. France, UK, US, people from around the world have been looking to go to Australia. And now the rental markets in Sydney and Brisbane and other cities are really starting to heat up. And it's starting to feel, when I look at the numbers, a bit like Dublin circa 2016, 17, 18, right? You have a lot of job opportunities, a lot of people looking to come from far corners of the world to what is a successful city. But people, I get this sense that people are starting to now turn against some of that inward migration into those two countries. And if the mood starts to turn, you may see restrictions on those visa numbers in somewhere like Australia, which would then actually limit the number of Irish who can go over there.
It's an interesting one because I think of two things immediately. First of all, I recall in Portugal, Lisbon, when Lisbon introduced their digital nomad visa, which aimed to allow people who were virtual and digital in their work, the ability to be present in Lisbon and to live and work there. They thought, I think, it would be great for the local economy, have these rich tech workers coming into the city, spending, contributing to the local economy. Big problem immediately was significantly drove up rent prices and pushed out locals who were living there because they just simply could not afford it. And then they rode back on the digital nomad visa pretty quickly, and I think either got rid of it or introduced big restrictions or just reduced the placements because of the effect that it had on their local economy. And I also, referencing the turn on public opinion on support for migrants and immigration, I reference our previous podcast, David, which was my experience in Canada. And this is starting to change in Canada as well. Again, the country of, you know, that's built in immigration, was so pro-immigration and has let in a lot of immigrants over the last number of years. You're now starting to see it being seen as a lightning rod for, you know, the reason why house prices have increased in the metro areas, the reason why the health service is under significant strain is because of a lot of people coming in, but resources and government allocating support and resources for the health service, for wider services, not keeping up. So it's becoming a bit of a problem across, you know, a lot of these Western countries that I'm not sure how you feel about it, but it seems to me like it just switched in the last year.
Yeah.
That there's a big change.
One thing I worry about Canada's numbers, I saw a chart in this just recently, that a country like China, which has, so people might remember that in China, they have had one child policy. And quite tragically, if a family is looking to have a child, they may very much wish for that to be a male, which means that some females end up getting aborted when the parents may discover that there's a girl. So you have an imbalanced sex ratio in China. It's about 104 males for every female. And there's research that shows that when you actually tilt the mix of males females towards more males, you can actually have a slightly more violent society, because there's going to be an underclass of males who don't end up partnering long term as they get through their kind of formative 20s, 30s, 40s years, and that can actually create some structural problems amongst young people in Canada. I need to just be sure on this, but I think I saw something of the order of the 20s, 30s, or 30s age cohort. It's now 109 to 100, and that tells me that, just like you're an example, Dale, you're an unvetted male who went over to Canada a couple of years ago, and you would have formed part of that ratio. Now, some of these things,
I've brought it down by one since I've left.
Yeah, you have. Well done for getting out and helping.
I made my contribution.
And look, and I want to be careful with this point, because the countries where you typically have imbalanced sex ratios tend to be developing countries. China, at least, was developing for quite some time. Russia, which has an imbalance in the other direction, more females than males, they, again, are just not in the developed West. A country like Canada, which is, may get a trend like this and may not have significant problems from it. And it's not so clear as well just how long people stay in a country like Canada, because as you are in that exhibit of, some people go over for a few years and then come home.
Well, just quick reaction, because it's an interesting point where actually the number of people who are going from, I believe it's either temporary visa to permanent resident or permanent resident to citizen, it's one of the two, has actually significantly dropped in the last number of years. And commentary in Canada has basically said that a reason for that is because of the affordability crisis, that wages are not strong enough, can't afford homes, and effectively that Canadian dream, if you will, that immigrants had aspired to, has somewhat extinguished and be realized.
Now this is where I can kind of just relate this back to Ireland. So yeah. I guess your point there is that, look, if challenges present in the country, sometimes it's unemployment, sometimes it's things that just get very expensive, people who move to a country don't actually stay. They may return home. Ireland had this experience after 2008, where significant numbers of Polish and Baltic states and other Eastern Europeans who had come into Ireland, many of them working in areas like hospitality and construction, when massive unemployment came along, significant numbers of those people went home. And the exodus of Polish, for example, has only furthered in recent years, even after Ireland's economy started to recover. Why? Because Poland's economy actually has leaped up much higher. It's taken off. And where you actually could describe the Polish in recent years in Ireland as being similar to what you mentioned in Canada, is that because Ireland has become more expensive, and particularly at least on the rental side anyway, house prices, housing is cheaper in Poland. So if you have an economy now which can provide you full employment, whereas previously Poland really struggled to provide opportunities to people. Why wouldn't you go back home, get the cheaper housing if that's where your family are? There's a real incentive to do that. So, the whole idea of restricting immigration, this is where, I'm always cautious when I see people looking to go really hard on migration restrictions, because there are features in our economies that can actually just turn people away naturally, whereby things get too expensive, people don't want to come, or if you have a phase of unemployment, it actually naturally leads people to leave. Now, what you don't want is the kind of brain drain and massive exodus that Ireland had through that time, because so many Irish left. The recent years have seen a more balanced number for the numbers that are leaving Ireland, of Irish citizens at least. There are as many returning. In fact, more recent years show slightly more. What I'm really interested in seeing is the number that comes out for this year. When Ireland does our population migration numbers, it's an April to April number, and we're in April now. So from April 23 to April 24, we're going to see what that is. That should capture the leap up in people going to Australia that gets so regularly quoted in the Dáil and in other quarters. People supposedly who were run out of the country by high rents and high housing prices. How many of those people actually took up their visa? Because just getting granted a visa doesn't mean that you take it up. And how many other people returned? Because Australia was in lockdown for quite some time. And I know that lifted about 2, 3 years ago, but theirs was so tight. And if people are only going for a couple of months or a year or two at a time, you're going to see just as many returning potentially as who are leaving.
One thing, not sure if this is even possible, but it'd be interesting to know how many Irish who had left come back, then leave again. Because I think, by moving back, there's a, I think of two things. One, there's a cultural adjustment. If you've been away for a long time, you have to kind of reintegrate yourself back into your home country, where actually you can feel, like you weren't from there, because countries change, people move on, social circles evolve. But then also, I think I'm curious to know as well, how many read about the recovery, read about the changes facing Ireland, and maybe had a bit of a different perspective when they got there. I'm not sure. Can does that
Just
data exist, David? Do you know?
to get clarity, you're saying someone who would have gone to Australia, then back to Ireland, but then said, look, I actually want to stay in Australia.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, so I actually don't know. I know that what I like to call the first phenomenon, so going to Australia and back, which is quite common, I call that boomerang emigration.
Yes.
It's people go out and back. Now, what you're saying then is there'd be another pivot back, pretty large portion. We're barely good at actually tracking
Fair.
the kind of current movements, but we can infer just by the numbers in and out being quite equal that there is this boomerang. That's the inference that I make from it. I mean, the big challenge for a country like Australia is that their house prices are obscenely expensive. I think it is the either top five or top seven most expensive cities in Australia, which is where somewhere like 80, 90% of the population are, because Australia is heavily urbanized. Buying the average house in those cities is more expensive than Dublin or any other Irish city. And
It
that's why
is,
you.
but I would argue you. And sometimes I saw this in Canada. It's more accessible though. So accessing, while yes, way more expensive, I agree with you on that. I think accessing the price is easier. So for example, you can get, a 5% mortgage, on a significant portion of the capital required, if you're a first-time buyer. Ireland, we had the challenges of, capital requirements by the CBI and by the central bank that made it out of reach for a lot of first-time buyers. So I think you're right, yes, expensive, but accessing the capital to buy it, I think, is easier.
Just on the point of affordability of accessing a mortgage, I mean, the key metric for me is actually the average age. So I always tend to say, look, what's the average age? Because a key theme for me that I've been talking about recently is this idea of a milestone recession. That young people, what really defines being young in the English-speaking West nowadays, is that your first home takes longer, your first marriage takes longer, and having kids takes longer. And for that reason, some people miss out entirely. The key metric for me is average age of first-time buyer. You're right. I've seen this before. I don't have the exact number, but the average age of buying a house in somewhere like Australia, even though it's way more expensive, may still be the late 20s or early 30s. Whereas in Ireland, I think it's in kind of the mid 30s. Partly though, what happens is that the Australian banks are going to give you like 8, 9 times your income. Whereas in Ireland, you're limited at 4. And effectively, you become a debt slave for the rest of your life. So if you are that movement that you
Yes.
mentioned, Dale, you went over to Australia, whether you stayed in Australia, went back to Ireland, and back again, you will be a debt slave. If you
Yes.
sign up to a mortgage there, bye-bye. Kids, grandkids, you're just not going to see them.
And but I think interesting point though is, while yes, you might be that debt slave, but you have a house. And you have a house
You
of your
do.
own. And I think
You do.
there's probably wider societal impacts on that and how that affects the political systems. Because, I think those countries, certainly Canada, Australia, they're not really seeing too much extremism, I would argue. And how that then transcends into politics, right? I think the reason I keep harping on about housing, and the reason why I think, David, you keep harping on about housing, is because we believe how fundamental having a house is to being part of a society and buying into society.
It's
And
a
what does that
social
mean then?
contract.
It's a social contract. And debt slave or not, they have a home, right? And they can then do what they want with that home and have the security that comes with a home, right? That you don't have it if you're renting.
I might just give a mention as well to the latest My Home survey or data which has come out. So the economists there, Colm Aquila and their team, they put out regular reports on asking prices. So My Home, because they're a website, they get a good sense of where the listings are. So why do I say that that's good information? If you're looking at the CSO, theirs is a bit dated because they're looking at tax filings and things that happen after you've gone sale agreed. But the asking price comes earlier. So it's a good metric of where the market's going. And it doesn't paint a good picture for young people because it looks like their data says we now have 6.5% year-on-year house price growth in asking prices. Where's wage growth in Ireland? It finished last year at around 2%. Now, that shows that prices are now still running ahead of where people's incomes are. But the reason I say this is significant, if you go back to the middle of last year, the reverse was true. So we had wage growth that had just tipped over 4% year on year, and house price growth was languishing around 2%.
So
So
it's
a gap,
flipped.
it's flipped. Yeah, a gap had opened up. Now I was really led to believe that this was, I wasn't so sure, I wasn't 100% sure of this, but I had hoped that this was a kind of a new beginning, a new trend that would actually hold. That trend being incomes rising faster than prices. That to me is how you'll ultimately fix, quote unquote, the housing crisis, is where incomes rise faster than prices. If we're now back in the scenario of the prices running faster than incomes, it's only going to push home ownership that bit further away from young people again.
And I'll give you a real anecdote on this, purely because my parents, who are avid watchers of local housing prices, like I think lots of old people are, the house across the road from our family home went for, and I'm from a, not a very average place, but the house across the road went for €100,000 above asking.
Hundred above
So,
asking, hundred
which
above asking.
is,
So I haven't heard a 100 above asking story
this did.
since about 21 or maybe into early 22. But 23 last year, a lot of that stuff went away. You used to hear of like apartments in Dublin 8 that were going for 100 quid, 100K above asking. To hear that back now in suburban Dublin again, it really is a worrying sign. Why is some of this happening? I mean, funny that this report cited higher wages, even though I've mentioned that the pace of wage growth has actually slowed a bit. But with all things of a growth metric, you still are at a higher level. Now, we do still have full employment. So you have a lot of people out there who are working good jobs. It could be two earners with two good jobs, and both of that will allow people to borrow. And where banks last year or up until the middle of last year were raising their interest rates, now they've mostly paused. In fact, AIB have announced a 0.2% reduction in some of their mortgage products. Not large, but it is a sign that with ECB maybe looking to lower interest rates sometime later this year, a bank like that decided to come along and say, look, we're going to get ahead of that and be competitive in the market. Other banks just have been flat on their interest rates for many months now. So I'd say a lot of people out there looking to buy, who previously were put off by the rising pace of interest rates, might be now looking and saying, you know what, these things are stable now. I'm willing to go out there and buy a house. And that might be something else, some other factor that's just pushing things a bit higher. The metric, though, that is worth watching too is the number of first-time buyers, the actual total number, because that number has been rising. And despite housing being quite unaffordable,
And it's the
there
one that the
has.
government keep on putting out as well, isn't it?
And sometimes I think, oh, that kind of in a way doesn't matter because housing is still expensive. But look, more people getting your first keys is a very important metric. I don't think that movement alone is enough to turn the perception of housing around when it comes politically back to the question of how the next election goes. But it is welcome to see. And you have a mix of things going on there. Some people accessing various schemes, some people building their own properties, other people just getting your classic way of going out and getting a mortgage. More of it is happening though, and it is good to see.
Well, we started off with a big change happening with the new Taoiseach, the new government, but it all comes back to housing and housing. And I think there is a lot to contend with new government has 10 months until the next election. I predict that housing will become and will be the decisive point in the next election. I think also, you know, law and order and all of that will play an important part in too. But I think the party that campaigns and wins the hearts and minds on housing is the party that will lead the next government. You mark my words. I think we're out of time, David. We've chatted for long enough, but great to see you again and look forward to our next podcast.
Thanks, Al. See ya.